we're on Daf Yud Amud Beis, and if you're counting from the bottom of the Amud, it should be approximately 10 lines up from the bottom. Amar Rabbi Elazar. So tonight we'll have a combination of Halacha and Agadatah. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Ir Sheruba Rotzni. You know, it's if the population of this city of refuge is now, you know, flooded with Rotzni. We'll have to see what the word Rotzni means. We're talking about Shogeg or Mezu. But in any event, the most of the population is made up of Rotzni. It's Eina Koletes. It loses its status as an Ir Miklat. And as a result, you know, Beis Din is going to have to guarantee that we add a populace. You know, we beef up the population of the city. And how does Rabbi Elazar know such a thing? We'll see that not everyone accepts this. Shenemar, because the pasuk, and it's interesting, this pasuk appears not in Chumash, but in Tanakh, in Sefer Yoshua. And there it says, V'diber bi'aznei ziknei ha'ir ha'hi es dvarav, which means that the Rotzeach has to present himself in front of the Ziknei Ha'ir, and he has to tell them that he killed someone b'shogeg, and therefore he wants to take advantage of the protection of the Ir Miklat. That's what it says in the pasuk in Yoshua. That pasuk somehow leads Rabbi Elazar to the conclusion that the population of the city is made up mostly of people who aren't Rotzeach. Because basically the Dvarim of the Rotzeach have to be different than the Dvarim of the Ziknei Ha'ir. Okay, so again, let's just set the rules of the game here in Rabbi Elazar's frame of reference. This is not something that I would call intuitively correct. You know, I don't know if we can sense the way this drasha works. It's not such a, how should I say, on a secular level, I don't know if the logic here is that compelling, but he understands the following, that they're like two sides, you know, there are two bodies, you know, it's like in color war, you know, you got the blue team and the red team. So there's one team of Medabrim, and there's another team of those who are not Medabrim, but they're Shomim. Those Shomim are called Ziknei Ha'ir, but the Ziknei Ha'ir really are representative of the basic makeup of the population of the city. And the Ziknei Ha'ir are those who would not be Medabrim. When we talk about Medabrim, Dvarav is Ritzicha, meaning the content and the substance of this story that has to be told in front of the Zekanim is that I killed B'shogeg. And that story has to be told to someone who's on the hearing end of the story. So it's sort of like if you imagine a case of an accused criminal who comes in front of a Beis Din, and he has to put forward his defense in front of the Beis Din. You know, so the members of the court and the person who's now being accused of a crime and is trying to defend himself are on two opposite roles, that they play two different roles. So the role of the Zekanim is to hear the Dvarim, and the role of the Rotzkim is to recite these Dvarim. And the Ziknei Ha'ir represent the majority of the city. And here's the last part of Rabbi Elazar's statement, his formulation. He says the following, that v'lo shehushvu divreihem l'dvarav. If at the end of the day there's an equal balance between his dvarim, meaning the Rotzkim, and the dvarim of the Ziknei Ha'ir, who are going to decide whether or not, in fact, he should be accepted as a member of the city and granted protection therein, they cannot be equal. There's got to be a bulk, a majority on the side of those who are listening, and the minority of those who are talking. That means that the city has to be made up primarily of non-Rotzkim. And the Aruch HaNer already points out here that the non-Rotzkim and the Ziknei Ha'ir are all one and the same in this context. The Aruch HaNer, by the way, also comes to another conclusion, and he wants to assume that the Ziknei Ha'ir, if they're going to judge this Rotzeach, they have to be made up of a Beis Din no less than 23 members. Do you remember this discussion that we had last time, that the Aruch HaNer is of the opinion that just like in order to condemn a murderer to death as a capital punishment, you need a Beis Din of no less than 23, so too to decide that a person was a rotzeach b'shogeg and therefore he's chayv in your miklat, you need the same exact bezdin of 23. I don't want to get off on a tangent with that, but you should know that the Aruch HaNer is here on Daf Yud Amud Beis. The Omer Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar says the following: Ir she'ein bo zkenim. What happens if a city does not a so-called ir miklat is now completely devoid of any zkenim? Eina koletes, it loses its status of an ir miklat. And why is that? To be inon zikne or ir v'leka. Right, and now we can go back to the Torah. Until now, we were talking about Yoshua, but now in the Torah itself, it's. No, I'm sorry, my mistake. We're still in Sefer Yoshua. It says v'diber bi'oznei ziknei ha'ir ha'hiyas dvarav v'leka. There's no ziknei ha'ir, and therefore it cannot qualify as an ir miklat. In other words, according to Rabbi Elazar, it's not just a mitzvah. It's not just a ritual to speak, to have the Rotzeach give his harangue, you know, his speech in front of the Zikne Ha'ir. That also defines the ingredients of an Ir Miklat. Without the Zikne Ha'ir, if that mitzvah cannot be fulfilled of a Dibur B'Ozni Zikne Ha'ir, then it's not an Ir Miklat. And once again, Beis Din is going to be in charge of guaranteeing that there is Kenim in the Ir Miklat.
What are they there? But you know, what are they doing?
According to the Aruch HaNer, they're going to be a Beit Din, but only if they number 23. Other than that, I guess they have to, in a sense, accept the argument of the Rotzeach, and then, you know, send them off to a different Beis Din for a final verdict. So, first of all, I want to read to you a line of the Meiri. The Meiri says, Lefichach says the Meiri, Mishtadlim she'lahamid zkenim bi'ari miklat. It's our responsibility to see to it that there is zkenim in the ir miklat. That's one thing I wanted to call to your attention. And then I wanted to call to your attention a very interesting question. You know, the Gemara says in Yuma that ein navi rashoy l'charish dov. A navi cannot introduce new halachas. He can't change the halachas, subtract, or add, or anything. You know, he can only tell you a hetel if he shah, but he can't be machadish. So no halachas are derived from the vua. So the question is, Yoshua as a Navi, what right does he have to determine the requirements of an ir miklat? And the answer is that Yoshua is not operating here as a machadish halachos, but rather he is bringing down the halachas that were given to Moshe at Har Sinai. Now, even though in the Torah, in scriptures, we don't find the Dibur Dvar Lufnei Ziknei Ha'ir, but nevertheless, Yoshua heard that from Moshe Rabbeinu, and that was part of the tradition that was passed on to him, what we call Halacha Moshe Mi'Sinai. I wanted to read to you one line in the Aruch HaNer, which I have no clue what it means, and if anybody could help me, I would be appreciative. The Aruch HaNer says, Ma b'kach sherov yoshvei ha'ir rotzmeh. He wants to know who cares if most of the population of the ir miklat is made up of rotzmeh. Harei mikolakom ziknei ha'ir einam rotzmeh. See, I don't understand his question because the premise of Rabbi Elazar is that the ziknei ha'ir are simply the representatives of the city itself. And we have to have a situation where there's a majority of quote-unquote Zekanim. In other words, somehow, the Aruch HaNer is assuming, which I can't figure out, that the Zekanim mentioned by Yoshua are a specific, well-defined group, and therefore, the Torah and Yoshua is just requiring that there be Zekanim. It doesn't say anything about the makeup, the population, the demography of the city, the demographics of the city. But that's not true. I mean, Rabbi Elazar's assumption is that the Zekanim represent the city as a whole.
I thought maybe, it's just a guess. You don't need the word Azne. It's Diber Lizikne Ha'ir. Maybe the word Azne is like Oznai, Mosnaim, somehow like Shikul.
Ah, you mean one, maybe he's darshaning that word.
Because I think that the idea that the leaders of the city represent that population is a modern idea. You know, that's based in the French Revolution, a lot of ideas.
Okay, but it goes back to Abelazo. I mean, he's not modern. I mean, maybe he was an advanced thinker, you know, but, you know, you go back almost 1800 centuries.
Why do you need a clear majority? That's what Rav's asking, clear majority?
No, he's not asking a philosophical question, Ochlinia. Why do you need a majority that's not Rotsman? You know, that's the drush of Rebelazar. But he's asking what justifies the drush and the conclusion of Rebelazar based on the pasuk that says Zikne Ha'ir. Who cares? This pasuk is only requiring Zikanim of the year. It doesn't mean that the general population, which is made up of people who aren't Zikanim, they're just rank and file citizens. You know, you got the water carriers and you know, and so forth. That they have to be non-Rotsdim. Let them all be Rotsdim. You know, as long as you have three Skatim in the city and the rest are Rotsdim, you fulfill the requirement, says the Ochlinair, of the Diber Biazne Zikne Ayir. But obviously, Rebbe Loz is not working with the same premise as the Ochlinair. He's assuming that the Zikne Ayir here are just representatives of the entire body of the population, and therefore their words, the Vrayim, have to be the majority relative to the Dvarim of the Rotsdim. If you have more Rotsdim than you have Zkanim, which means the population at large, then you don't have Hushu Divrei Mutvah.
How could the Orphanir go against Divrei Rebbe?
No, he gives some sort of an answer, but frankly speaking, I don't understand his answer.
He's going against Rebbe Rotsdim's principle. But you need roads.
No, again, he's going to give an answer. I'm just explaining that I don't figure out his question. The premise of the question was. So you want to see his answer, I mean, I'll show it to you inside, but not for now. Okay, now where else do we find the requirement of Zkanim? We found it here in your Mikla. Where else do we find Zkanim mentioned?
Egla Rufa.
What else?
Ben Sarumon.
Excellent. Ben Sarumon. So those are the three cases that Rebbe Loz is going to call our attention to, and he's going to make some sort of a lishitasa. You know, there's going to be a consistency here. Then in every parasha where we require Zkanim, the city has to have Zkanim. Itmar. Ir she'ein bo Zkanim, a city without Zkanim. So again, according to Rebbe Loz, it cannot be an ir miklat, because the Torah says, or I should say the Tanakh says, v'dim brosnei zikne ir. But this was the subject of a controversy between Rav Ami and Rav Asi. Okay, this is already at the time of the Amoraim. Chad, one of them said, koletis, despite the fact that it doesn't have zikneh. V'chad omar, eino koletis. Lamandi omar, eino koletis. We've already seen Rav Lazar, who says that since the Torah, the Tanakh says v'dim brosnei zikneh, they have to be zikneh. Be'inon zikneh ir v'lek. What's the other opinion, which in effect rejects Rabbi Lozar? Lemandi omer koletes is lemitzvah mitzvah bi'alma. In other words, as long as there are zkanim, we can fulfill this extra mitzvah of the diber bi'ozni zkanim. But that doesn't define the requirements and the prerequisites for any mitzvah. And now we're going to see the same Rav Ami and Rav Asi over and over again. The ir she'ein bo zkanim. Now we're talking about Ben Sora Morir. Rav Ami and Rav Asi have an argument. Chad Omar, one says nasib on Ben Sora Morir. We can judge him for death, even though there are no zkanim. We'll send him off to a bezdin and we'll judge him. Chad Omar ein nasib bo Ben Sorer Umorer, because here too, with regard to Ben Sorer Umorer, it says that the father should take his son, or the mother should take her son, to the Zikne Ha'ir. Laman di Omar, Ein Nasibas Ben Sorer Umorer. Why is that? Because the Inon, the Tafsu, I'm going to read the entire passage. The Tafsu bo Avi v'ima bo Tzio so El Zikne Ira. That the parents take him to the Zkanim in that city, in their local city. The Lekka, we don't have any Zkanim in this city. So that means the ear for Ben Sora Morir is disqualified, because there's no Zkanim in the city. Ulamandi Omar, Nasib of Ben Sora Morir, according to the other Mandi Omar, the Torah says Zikne Iro, Mitzvah the Alma. Does the parents should fulfill that mitzvah if the city has a bezdin with zkanim in it? If the city doesn't have this zkanim, so it doesn't matter as far as the law of Ben Sora Morir is concerned, we'll just drop the mitzvah. So again, we're seeing a consistency here when the Torah describes a situation of a city with this Canaan. Is that just for a mitzvah? It embellishes a mitzvah? It adds a mitzvah? Or does it define the basic essence, the prerequisite for that city?
Does the Canaan mean based in?
So Canaan means best.
So then the mitzvah Abba means take him to a different city.
Correct. Yeah, we're going to have to take him to a different city. And finally, we have the third case that you mentioned before, Mitch, and that's Egla Rufa. Ir she'ein bas Canaan. Can there be an Egla Rufa in such a city? And the answer is Ravami Vravasi. You guessed it, the same old machlokas. Chad Omar Mevia Egla Rufa, v'chad Omar Eina Mevia Egla Rufa, v'man di Omar Eina Mevia Egla Rufa, v'inon, because the pasuk says, v'lachu ziknei ha'ir ha'hi, Eglas Bakar, so the Torah mentions the ziknei ha'ir, v'lekin the nose, canem in the city, v'man di Omar Mevia Egla Rufa. It means mitzvah bi'alma, when the Torah says ziknei ha'ir, it only is a mitzvah. Now on this we have Tosfos, Divrei Maskil Chad Omar, and Tosfos is of the opinion that based on the Mishnah and Sota, it should be a Dover Pashut that the Egla Rufa has to come from a city that is equipped with a Bezdin, because the Gemara there says that if you find a slain body between two cities or between a cluster of cities, then we do what's called medida, which means we measure the distance between the dead body and the cities, and we come up with the shortest distance, and that's the city that is in charge of the process of Egla Rufa. But the Gemara says we only make that medida with regard to a city that has a bezdin. If the city is not equipped with a bezdin, then it's not even a candidate for Egla Rufa, and therefore there's no medida. So Tosfos comes to the answer, to the conclusion, that if there are no other candidate cities that have a Bezdin, then according to this particular Man D'Omar, we don't know if it's Ravami or Ravasi, but you would do the Egla Rufa from that city. If you have a number of candidate cities, then we give first choice to the city that's equipped with a Bezdin, because in that sense we could be Mekayim the Mitzvah of Alaku Zikne Ahir Hahi Eglas.
So even if there's a city closer without a king?
Right. And this is a whole sugya in the second of Basra about Rove and Koro. Either the closest city, Lakoro, would logically be the city from which the Rotzeach came, and yet you're not going to bring the Egla Rufa from that city, because that city doesn't have a Bezdin. You'll bring it from another city which is further away because it has a Bezdin. Okay. Omar Rav Chama Bar Chanina. And now we get to a little bit of Agadita at the very end of Yud Amud Beis, going on to Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. B'vnei ma nimra parshas rotzchim b'loshan aza. The premise here is that there are two words for speech in the scriptures. There's one amira and there's one dibur. Dibur, as opposed to amira, means very harsh words. That's called loshan aza. Now, if you take a look in Sefer Yoshua, so Rashi points out on the top of Yud Aleph Amud Beis, you will always consistently find the word Amira, Vayomer Hashem. The exception to the rule is when we get to Arei Miklat. With regard to Arei Miklat, all of a sudden there's a shift, the transition from Vayomer, which is a soft language, to Vayedaber, or some form of Dibur. For example, the Chsiv in Perek Chaf, it says in Sefer Yoshua, Vayedaber Hashem al Yoshua Lemar. And then again, a second time, it says, Daber al Bnei Yisrael Lemar. The third time, Tunu Lechem es Arei HaMiklashar Dibarti Aleichem. Three times over, the Torah consistently, the Tanakh uses the word Diva with referring to Arei Miklat. So whenever the Torah indicates the command of God in the midst of establishing the Arei Miklat, it always utilizes the term dibur, and therefore it's lashon kasher, and therefore we have this statement of Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina that the parshas rotzchim is given b'lashon aza. The Gemara is now going to question this from many different psukim in Torah and in Tanakh. Is it really true that the word dibur implies a lashon kashon? The Marsha wants to know, why would the Torah give the parsha of Ari Miklat b'lashon kashon? So here I want to refer you to something in the back here, which I found in the Yalkut HaBi'urim, and he says something quite amazing. The real chat. You remember we earlier had the sugya of Moshe Rabbein with regard to the three cities of refuge, Be'evra Yarden, and Moshe designated these cities despite what fact? They didn't have the power to be kolet. But Oev Kesev Lo Yisbar Kesev, and Moshe won. In the case of Yehoshua, he quotes here a Sifri, and this is already Eretz Yisrael proper, the three cities of refuge in Eretz Yisrael, that based on the pasuk at the end of Bamidbar, it says Ve'kresem Lachem Arim, that pasuk indicates that those cities of refuge are only activated after the 14 years of Yerusha V'Yeshiva, meaning there were 7 years of kibush, of conquest of the land, and
Milchama.
What did he say?
And Milchama.
Milchama, correct, Milchama. Milchama to conquer the land that's rightfully ours. Don't get any ideas here, you know, we have to say things that are politically correct. Okay. If you didn't understand my hint, then that's good. You know, Liebman is not around. He would certainly get there. Okay. So at what point in time would the cities of refuge in Eretz Yisrael be activated, and therefore they would activate Yom? Only at the end of the 14-year period. Good. And that's exactly what Yehoshua did. He waited until after the 14 years to designate these three cities. However, Af Shaloi Chayv Lafrisham Ad Osa Ace, technically he was not obligated, Yehoshua, to separate them until after the 14 years. Mikolakom Hayelo Lilmod Mimosha Rabbeinu Shinizdaris Bafrashis Arim Shabevra Yardin Af Shadayin Lo Higiyaz Manam Liklo. And therefore, he should have designated them somewhat earlier and jumped the gun, so to speak, because Oed Kesef Lo Yispa Kesef. I don't know, I thought that was pretty fascinating. This he quotes in the name of some sefer called Siach Yitzchak, which I'm not familiar with. He goes on and adds another piece here. He says, Ne'af li'akash gomru l'chaleg lo nizdariz Yehoshua l'afrish. And he says, perhaps Yehoshua delayed even after the 14 years, but he doesn't give any justification as to why Yehoshua did such a thing. In any event, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he's telling Yehoshua, hey, what's going on here? He's using the harsh language of Dibur, because Yehoshua was, according to this particular approach, we'll have other approaches, but Yehoshua is dilly-dallying, and he should have done it early. L'meimra, says the Gemara, are you meaning to tell us, Rav Tanina, that kol, to kol Dibur, lashon kasher? If that's case, show me a paradigm. And the paradigm for this is the case of the brothers telling Father Jacob exactly what kind of tone of voice the leader, the viceroy of Mitzrayim used, right, Yosef used. Kidiksiv diber ha'ish adonai ha'aretz itanu kashos. Which means that they were accused of espionage. The Gemara says, okay, you found one case, but that doesn't make it into a rule. Hasanya, we learned in a Braisa, and this Braisa is interpreting a pasuk at the very, very tippy end of Tanakh, a very, very famous pasuk and a very profound pasuk. Oz nidbru yir Hashem yishal re'ehu, the word nidbru, and Chazal understand that this is a discussion about Elio Anovi coming as the harbinger of Mashiach. Nidbaru, ein nidbaru elalosh anachas. The Braisa says that the word nidbaru has to be understood as speaking in a calm, low tone, which is appropriate for Yirei Hashem. Now, Yirei Hashem don't get excited, they don't start screaming, they lower their voice. So we should all be zochet to be Yirei Hashem and never raise our voices. V'cheinu omer, and also the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Yidaber amim tachtenu. It means that God will subjugate the nations of the world, and they will actually be comfortable to be subjugated under our leadership. Right? Halva, right? Yeah. Okay. So here in my Gemara it says Yidaber. Yidaber am tachtenu. What do you have, Rabbi?
I have Yadber.
You have Yadber. Okay, good. So it should be Yadber then. So Yadber amim tachtenu. And you see from this brisa that the word dibur means benachas, because again we're saying that the nations of the world will comfortably accept our sovereign dominion over the nations. So the Gemara answers, wait a minute, let's not equate daber with yadber. Okay, we'll say it as yadber, be more careful than we were before. And what it means is that the word diber or daber, which appears three times in Yoshua with regard to Ir Miklat, and appears in the case of diber of the brothers, that's Lashon Azo, that's Lashon Kosher, but Nidberu is a Lashon of Nachas. Now we have a Machlokas Tanoim. Why did Hashem actually speak to Yoshua in this very harsh language? Pligibod is machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabban. Chad Omer mipnei she'shiham. This is what we saw before in the Siach Yitzchak, that there was an opportune moment for Yoshua to designate the cities, and he did not take advantage of that moment, which either means at the end of the 14 years or even earlier. The Chad Omer mipnei she'hem sheltor. Now, what does that mean? Just because we're talking about a mitzvah shel Torah, therefore we use a lashon aza. So my suggestion would be the following, and then I'll tell you what the Marsha has to say. I suggest that when the Rabbanon institute a mitzvah, they do it for our benefit, and it's quite clear that they're acting out of a sense of love and compassion for the people. The Torah is already Gzeiros HaKosu. That's already Lashon Kosher. You understand the mitzvah, you don't understand the mitzvah. The Torah is demanding. My Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, whenever he wanted to give an example of a mitzvah which is almost impossible for us to imagine, he would talk about the mitzvah of Simchas Yogdiv for an oven. Do you remember this? And it's written up in all his essays. He always comes back to that example. Imagine you buried one of your close relatives a half hour before Shkia on Erev Sukkot, and the halacha requires you an hour later to be mesameach on Yontif like any other Jew. You have no exemption from the mitzvah. How can we understand that? Where's the compassion of God? But I'm just saying that it's almost impossible for... Again, you know, you'll hear stories about all the giants and the Gdolim who did this. I'm not... You know, but you've got to be a god for such a thing. I remember we had a student in our yeshiva, David Kahn. I remember this goes back, I was 20 years ago. And his father died a day before Sukkot. And he was being brought for burial in Beit Shemesh. You know, the new... Now it's no longer new, but those are the Eretz HaKai Beit Shemesh. And it was timed for 1.5 hours. The burial, because the body was coming from LA, the burial would take place 1.5 hours before Shkia on Erev Sukkot, on the 14th day of Tishrei. I'll never forget it. We waited, we were a minion of guys from the yeshiva, and we didn't know what to do. It was now 1.5 hour before Shkia, we're in Beit Shemesh, we have to get to Yerushalayim. And somebody says, you see the Chevra Kaddish. It was the fastest burial in history. I mean, never. We buried him, and we just flew out, you know, to Yerushalayim. We just made it in time for Shkia. But imagine, you know, this case with the Samachta Bechagecha Vayisa Asameh. It's impossible. Then the Rav used to talk about a Chassan Kala come back from the wedding, and she sees a Tipa Stam Kechar. And they cannot consummate the marriage. And about this, the Torah says, Suga Kishoshan. What's separating you from her? A hedge of roses. So, you know, It's very nice, you know, in NCSY and all the Kiva books, they should say the Torah is a bunch of, you know, it's all roses and everything is sweet smelling and everything. But there are some tough points to the Torah. That's why I call it Xeris HaKos. We don't understand it. The laws of Nida are very tough. And if you're teaching that to a Chosin or a Kala and you try to make light of it, then you're not doing anyone justice. You know, this is where we have to live up to the demands of the Torah. So the Gemara says that Divrei Torah are kashim. A mitzvah shel Torah is given with a certain, you know, a midas adin, you know, a certain imposition. And it's strict and it's required, and you may understand, you may not understand, you may be comfortable with the mitzvah, you may not be comfortable with the mitzvah. It matters not. And that's where we test your emunah. If it's a mitzvah shel Torah, okay, that's a little different. You know, kosomar lebeis Yaakov asagit lebnei Yisrael. You know, when you're talking to the women folk, maybe emphasize more the compassionate part of the Torah. But even to the women folk, at some point, it's kosher kegilah. You know, you have no choice in that. So that's the second opinion. Of course, most of what Hashem gave to Yoshua was midrabanan, because the Doraisas were given already to Moshe Rabbeinu and incorporated in Torah Shebichtav. But here's the exception, because Moshe Rabbeinu was unable to cross the Jordan, unable to establish the Arim Miklat, and therefore that mitzvah shel Torah had to be imposed upon Yoshua. The pasuk says in Yoshua Perek Chaf Dalet, Vayichtov Yoshua Sadvar Ma'ela B'Sefer Torah Selokim. What exactly is Yoshua inscribing in a book that's called Toras Elokim? After all, who wrote Toras Elokim? Moshe Rabbeinu. Pliba Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Nechem. It's a machlokus between two Tanoim about this issue. Chad Omer, Shmona HaPsukim, the last eight Psukim, which record post-death of Moshe Rabbeinu. Which itself, by the way, is a problem. You know, that there are eight psukim that, according to this opinion, that are not written by Moshe. That's not a simple matter. Chad, the other opinion, Omer, are a miklat. That this is called Toras Elokim because this is the chapter that embodies a mitzvah shel Torah, which really, in a sense, belongs to Toras Elokim, belongs to the Torah, but it was actually written by Yoshua. Bishleim Laman, the Omar Shmona Psukim, Hainu Ditsiv. Then we understand why it's called Sefer Torah Selokim, because it was incorporated into Torah Shebichtav. El Laman, the other according to the opinion, who says Ari Miklat, what does it mean, Sefer Torah Selokim? I mean, we only know that Yoshua wrote his own Sefer. He didn't write the book of Moses. He didn't write the last eight psukim of the book of Moses. So why is it called Torah Selokim? Hachikam. This is what it means. Vayitov Yoshua b'sifro es hadvar ma'elak suvi b'sefer Torah Selokim. In other words, he wrote the parsha of Ari Miklat, which itself is incorporated in Torah Sefer Elokim. Meaning, he added specific laws that were given through Moshe Rabbeinu as a transmission of Halacha Moshe B'Sinai. And they embellish that which is written in Torah Elokim. It has sort of a quasi-status, or at least could be described, as the Sefer Torah Elokim. Now the Gemara goes into one of the laws that have to do with a Sefer Torah. This is a little bit on a tangent. And the Gemara says the following. Sefer Shetfaro B'Pishtan. So in other words, every Yeriah of the Sefer Torah has to be attached to the Yeriah that comes before it, and then in turn to the one afterwards. And in this case, what they used for the Tefirah was Pishtan. And the question is whether Pishtan is kosher for Tefiras Chutei HaYeriahs. Pliba Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Meir. Chad Omer kosher, Chad Omer posel. What are they arguing about? And hopefully if we understand their argument, we can figure out why it's here in Masechta Makkos in this particular context. Lamani, according to the one who says Pasul Dixiv, because in the parasha of Tefillin it says V'hoi l'choli os al yadcha u'zikaron b'nei necha l'man tia toras Hashem b'ficha. There's that same phrase, toras Hashem. And Iskish, we have an equation between the entire Torah and Tefillin. Now we're going to see that with regard to Tefillin, there's a separate Aloch L'Moshe Mi-Sinai that would exclude Pishtan for Tefiras Tefillin. Now if you take out your Batim of Tefillin, you will see that they are sown with Gidin that come for a kosher animal, but not with Pishtan that comes from that's linen. So again, the Torah says, with regard to Tefillin Leman Tia Torah Hashem Beficha, which postulates an equation between Tefillin and Torah Hashem, all of the Torah itself, in this case the Sefer Torah. And the Gemara derives from that Hekesh Ma Tefillin Aloch L'Moshe Misina L'Tofra Begidin, to the exclusion of anything else, including Pishtan. Af Kol, so too, the entire Sefer Torah is L'Tofram Begidin. They can only be sewn up with Gidin, and therefore Chutei Pishtan are excluded. The Idach, what about the other man, the Omar? In other words, does he deny the equation that seems to be quite clear in this pasuk between Tefillin and the balance of the Sefer Torah? Ki iskash lemutar beficha. He wants to use this hekesh for one specific halach, and that's lemutar beficha. And this has to do with the cloth itself, the parchment upon which the Sefer Torah is written, has to be the same parchment upon which Tefillin are written, and that's got to be minamutar beficha, meaning it has to be hides of a kosher animal which can be eaten, but not the hides of a non-kosher animal. Hilchosa, meaning for other halachos of Tefillin, lo iskash. We don't have a hekesh between Sefer Torah and the balance of the halachos of Tefillin. And therefore, with regard to the requirement of Tefillah, which has to be begidin, that's a unique halacha in Tefillin. And we cannot extrapolate from that to Sefer Torah. Therefore, Sefer Torah, you can sew up the Urios with Chutei Pishtan according to that mandiyot. Omar Rav, this closes the whole sugya, then we start the Mishnah of Mitzvah Shem. Chazinan lehu l'tfilin debei chabibi. Rav says he saw the tefillin of his uncle. Rabbi Chiya was his uncle. It's interesting, Rabbi Chiya was a Tana. Rav is on that borderline period, but usually we assume Rav is an Amora. He cannot argue with the Mishnah, though sometimes it says Rav Tanu Upali. So he saw the tefillin of his uncle. The tefir of the kiss, in fact, the tefiros of his uncle's tefillin were with Pishtan. And we only had a debate about Sefer Torah, but as far as tefillin is concerned, it was quite clear that you need gidin, the sinews of an animal, but less hilchos kavase, and we don't paskin like Rabbi Chiya, and therefore we require tefira begidin. This is a very difficult sugya. I'll just raise a number of questions on this sugya. Number one, we have a principle called ein hekesh l'mechta, and yet the Gemara here, in explaining the shita of, get the name straight here, the shita of Rabbi Meir, okay, we're not sure if it's Rabbi Meir of Yehuda, is limiting this hekesh to mina mutar beficha. The second question I want to ask you is, if tefira begidin is halach l'moshe misinai, the Rambam establishes clearly that there's no machlokas in halach l'moshe misinai, and yet here Rabbi Chiya did not accept this halacha. How can there be a machlokas about halacha L'Moshe Misina?
Yeah, it wasn't on my focus. You just never knew. You didn't hear. How'd you told him? There's a lot of Misina. I didn't know.
But the language of Les Hilchos HaKavase is difficult. I like your pshat. You're probably right. But Les Hilchos HaKavase, he says here, Ein Halacha Kemoso B'Nimza, which implies that there was a Plukta about it. And the Rambam says no Plukta on Halacha L'Moshe Misina.
The Ritva and the Toshan say that it's a mistake. He says it should say Chazinu D'Sifrei Sifrei Torah to be.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense, right? There's another girsa that the case of Chavivi, of Reb Chiya, was not a case of Tefillin, because Tefillin is no question, Halacha Moshe Sinai, it was a case of a Sefer Torah. And that we had a bona fide machlokas of Hekesh Lemechza, whether we limit the Hekesh. By the way, does anybody know the source in Halacha for the exemption of women from time-bound mitzvahs? Tefillin. The Gemara tries many attempts. At the end of the day, it falls on tefillin. That women are exempt from tefillin, and that's based on the hekesh to Talmud Torah, Torah Sashem Beficha, and women are excluded from Talmud Torah because Shinat Vanecha. And the Gemara then says that just like tefillin were an exempt, we're going to equate all mitzvahs to tefillin, any mitzvah that has that quality that it's time bound because we pass the Laila Lavzman tefillin, is women are exempt from. So this opinion that Ki Iskish Lamuta Beficha does not seem to be the accepted opinion, but nevertheless, if we take the gears to the Ritva, it would seem that we're applying the principle, we're limiting that hekesh only to Gibin, only to Tefir Begibin of a kosher animal. Okay, Rabosai, how many types of Kohanim Gedolim do we have? So we're going to see that there are really four categories of Kohanim Gedolim, and the question is which one's death is going to free the Rotzeach Peshogeg from the Ir Miklat. So the Mishnah says the following. According to the Tanakhama, only three out of four qualify. Echad Mashruach B'Shemen HaMishcha. Rashi says that Heim HaKohanim Gedolim Shahayu Ad Yoshio HaMelech. At the time Yoshio HaMelech, the Shemen HaMishcha was put into Gneza. All the Kohanim Gedolim up until Yoshio HaMelech were indeed anointed with Shemen HaMishcha.
The time period is that exactly?
I think it's about 2600 years ago. I don't have the calendar in front of me, but you can get a calendar at the introduction to Pirkei Avos of the art school Pirkei Avos.
He has the whole beginning of the Second Temple.
It's even after that. I mean, it's way before that, I'm saying. Now, what happens after Yoshio HaMelech when we no longer have the Shemen HaMishcha? Do we do away with the principle of Kohen Gadol? No. There's another way of sanctifying a Kohen as a Kohen Gadol, and that's called what? Merube Begadim. That's called Chinuch B'Shmone Begadim. Mechanchon, he does the avod of a Kohen Gadol with white wearing the eight big day kuna gadolah. And they have the status of a Kohen Gadol no less than that of the Kohen Gadolim of the period of Yoshua. And that's what Rashi says, V'yechad Merubah Begadim, Hein Sheshim Shumi Yoshiyahu V'yelech, Shenigna Shemen HaMishcha, K'namir Bahorios, V'shuv Lo Nimshechu Kohanim, V'lo Haysani Keres, how did they establish a Kohen Gadolah? B'ribui Begadim, Shemeshamesh Beches Begadim. So that's category number two. Now, before we get to category number three, I want to introduce a gevaldig kasha of the Ritva. The Gemara later on says that how many Kohanim Gedolim have to die to allow the Rotzeach to go free? Do all the Kohanim Gedolim have to die? Says the Ritva, apparently, you could have more than one Kohen Gadol living at the same time, simultaneously. According to Rashi says that the Kohen Mashuach Melchama, I'm sorry, we didn't get the code. The Kohen Mashuach B'Shem HaMishcha was up until Yoshio HaNavi. Once they put away the Shemen HaMishcha, then all the Kohenim were B'Shmon HaBegadim. You can never have two Kohenim Gedolim living simultaneously. What was Gemara asking? That do we have to wait till both Kohenim Gedolim die? And based on this question, the Ritva says that we have to conclude that even at the time of Yoshio HaMelech, there could have been a Kohen Merubah Begadim. For example, he says that maybe they didn't have access to the Shemana Mishka, or maybe the Kohen Gadol with the Shemana Mishka was no longer able to function, but they didn't want to depose him, so they had to appoint the second Kohen Gadol, which they couldn't do through the Shemana Mishka, because there already was a Kohen Mashiach for Shemana Mishka. In any event, the Ritva has to work overtime here to come up with a situation in which at one point in time you can have both a Kohen Mashiach for Shemana Mishka and a Kohen Meruba Begad. And finally we come to the third category of a Kohen Gadol, and that's called Echad Sha'ovar Mi Mishichuso. In other words, he had some sort of psul. Rashi says She'ira psul b'Kohen Gadol, and as a result Shimesh Acher Tachtav. But Rashi says that the psul of the first Kohen Gadol was not a permanent, irreversible one. Ukshinisrape Kohen, Chazar Liavodosa. So Kalakodim Zoch, the first Kohen Gadol, gets right to be a Kohen Gadol. He was only replaced temporarily. Now, when we reinstitute the first Kohen Gadol, the second one, who's like the second string Kohen Gadol, he now is removed from the status of a Kohen Gadol, and he can no longer serve in the Beis HaMikdash as the Kohen Gadol. But nevertheless, he still has the status of a Kohen Gadol, even though he's been replaced, in a sense, or we have reinstituted the first Kohen Gadol. So his title, and we'll have to see the sugya how we define his status, is called Mashuach She'ovar, or Ovar Mimashichuso. And even his death would be sufficient, according to one opinion, to bring about the freedom of the Rotzeach, and therefore the Mishnah goes on to say, Machzirin es Harotzeach. They bring the Rotzeach back to his original city or wherever the heck he wants to live. That's up to him. But in any event, the gates are open for him and all the Rotzeachim to leave the Irma.
And the gold dump is not allowed.
Right. He's already achieved his full kapar. He's reinstated as a regular citizen. Rabbi Yudin's going to add a fourth category of a Kohen Gadol.
Well, the city empties out except for the
so then the Gol Adam could go into the city. If what? I thought you were asking that what happens if the Irma Miklat lost its status in Irma. You're not asking that question. You're asking who were living, which Rotskim were living in the Irma Miklat. I guess just as Canaan were living in the Irma Miklat at that point.
And the shopkeepers and all that.
Yeah, no, and when I say Skanim, I mean, as representing the population. So, in a sense, that's a happy day for the Rotskim. It might not be such a happy day for us when you let all your enemies out of jail. Like 1,000 enemies could say, all right, whatever.
But they're inadvertent killers. They're shogi.
Right, correct. So they're only shogi. So we're hoping they're not going
to... Opposed to who you're
right, those are not shogi. Some of those guys are back in jail again, serving the second round. So now, Rabbi Yehuda adds a fourth category, and that's called the Kohen Mashuach Milchama. You remember in Parshas Ki Tetzeh, the Torah designates a certain Kohen for making a declaration in front of the people who are going out to battle, the Mitzvah Milchama, that those who fit into any of the following categories will have to drop out of the Milchama, and that Kohen was in charge of that entire episode, that entire ritual. And he too has the status, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda, of a Kohen Gadol. Even though he's not really a Kohen Gadol, he doesn't do any of the avod of Kohen Gadol. His unique responsibility is only with regard to the mitzvah of Milchama, but nevertheless Rabbi Yehuda has a ribui, because the Torah repeats the parsha of Ad Mos Kohen Gadol, not three times, but four times, and therefore it has to include a fourth category. Now, obviously, the people in the Irma Miklat who are really plotting to go back to their original cities, they've had enough of the Irma Miklat, they really are waiting for the day that the Kohen Gadol dies. That's a very strange kind of situation. Says the Mishnah, Lefichach, and therefore, Imoseyem shel Kohanim, meaning of the Kohanim Gedolim, Mesapkos lahem michya uksus. the mothers of the Kohen Gadol, we have to see why the mothers and not the wives. Hey, we have the wives. I don't mean wives in plural. I mean the Kohen Gadol might be married to one woman, but I mean the wives in terms of the general Kohen Gadol, each one respected. But in any event, the mothers have compassion on their sons, and therefore they are motivated to make life in the Ir Miklat as comfortable as possible, as beneficial as possible. You know, offer them free rent, offer them free food, you know, clothe them with the finest, you know, linen garments, who knows what. And what's the goal? That the Rotzlim are so comfortable, they're living it up. Kidei shelo yispalu al b'neihem shiyamus. And what we're going to see here in the entire Agadita that's going to ensue is that there is a power in the tefillah of the Rotzeach to bring about the demise, the death of the Kohen Gadol. And the Gemara is going to be very, very uncomfortable initially about that. Why does the Rotzeach have the right to have such an impact, Lamala, up in the heavens, to bring about the death of he who is perhaps the most important role of anyone, of any leader in Klal Yisrael? If he's not the most important, he's up there on the top. Next, we're going to have to ask why the mothers of the Kohen, why the Kohen themselves shouldn't be involved in this process. And finally, why their wives aren't involved in the process. So as far as the question as to why the Kohanim themselves are not involved, there's a long discussion here in all the Achronim. Each one has something else to say. I'm just going to pick and choose. The Ben Yehoyada, who's the Ben Ishchai, he says that for the Kohen Gadol himself to offer food and any sort of parnasa to the Rotzim, that would be a zilzul b'chvodo shel kod. Shehei nitzrach lefayes es harotzim b'shgodol. V'afilum yirtza lasos kein yesh bi'ad bezdin u'bi'ad Yisrael l'noa oso mikach. Because as you well recall, the din of kabdehu, of giving kavod to the Kohen Gadol, is not a personal issue with regard to the Kohen Gadol. It's not something that he can be mochel on, but rather he represents the entire institution of Kohuna Gadol. And the Ben Yehoyada wants to go a step further. He says, v'chein lo yanichu le'ishto lasos kein, Lefisha ishto no telus mi mamono shalo litzorach kach viadayin yesh bem zulzul. See, I thought he was going to invoke the principle of ishto kugufo, but instead he says that where is she going to get her money? She doesn't have any independent rights. Again, she could be independently wealthy, and then maybe she would do that, but in a normal case, she's taking the possessions of the Kohen Gadol, and that also is an insult that is derogatory for the institution of Kohuna Gadol. On the other hand, the mother of the Kohen Gadol, she's taking her own possessions and she's motivated by her compassion for her son. That's not in any way insulting to Kohuna Gadol. That's what I saw in the Ben Yehoyada. As I indicated before, there are many other approaches to this issue. Frank, the Gemara, Minani Mil.
Does the Kohen Gadol have to be married?
Yes. He has to be married. He must be married. Otherwise, he can't serve.
He has to have a mother. Right.
He doesn't necessarily have a mother, but he has to have a wife. If he doesn't have a mother, then he's really in difficult straits.
To do the avoda, but the kumshua.
He needs a wife. He doesn't need a
shavar, right, whose wife passed away, and he's already stepped down.
So he can't serve unless he marries another woman.
No, but he still has the din, or status, of a Kohen Gadol, right?
Oh, as far as the death, I don't know. That's an interesting question. Rav Aaron is asking a following question. I'm going to throw this out in front of the Chabur. You know, Yesh Lacha. What happens if someone has the status of a Kohen Gadol, but he cannot serve because he doesn't have a wife? And Lechora, as you point out very well, he's not inferior to Kohen She'avar Mishichusa. A Kohen She'avar Mishichusa is enjoined from doing the Avoda because we reinstated the first Kohen Gadol, and yet his death would generate the freedom of the Rotzeach. So I would say that a Kohen Gadol, even though right now he can't do the Avoda, we have to encourage him to find a wife quick, pronto, but nevertheless his death would still bring about the freedom of the Rotzeach.
I was just thinking, what, you know, the Rav asked, why it says mother, not wife? Everyone has a mother, but not everyone has a wife.
Well, what do you mean everyone has a mother? I mean, not everyone has a mother.
Okay,
I mean, I wish I had a mother, but
they passed on. But Yevadai, there's no question. At one point,
yeah. Why would that be?
If we were saying the mothers of the Kohanim Gadolim.
Kohen Gadol had a mother, but she passed away. What do we do now? Who's praying on his behalf? According to the Ben Yoyot, the Kohen Gadol himself can't get involved. His wife can't get involved. You know, we may have to appoint a surrogate mother to pray on me. I don't know. That's a very interesting question. All right. Let's just, we have 5-10 minutes. Let's see if we can just begin to crack open the machlokas here regarding Kohen Mashiach Melchon Pichin Chacham Rav Yehuda. Minani Mil. How do we know that there are three, according to the Chacham, three categories of Kohen Gadol? Omar Av Kahana, the Omar Kro, the Torah repeats itself not once, not twice, but thrice with regard to the death of the Kohen Gadol and the freedom that's brought therein. V'yashav Ba, number one, Admos HaKohen HaGadol. Number two, ki be'ir miklato yeshiv ad mos hakoin agadol, and the third pasuk, v'achrei mos hakoin gadol, he goes free. Three times the Torah repeats the story of the freedom of the rotzech at the death of the kohen gadol. Why is it that the death of the kohen gadol incurs the freedom of the rotzech? That we'll see in this Haggadah Torah, which explains why the rotzchim have the ability to pray for the death of the kohen gadol. So again, three times, can I get three different Kohanim Gadol? Rabbi Yehuda says, no. It's not just three, there's a fourth pasuk, Sivkra Achrina, Lashuv Lasheves Ba'aretz Ad Mos HaKohen. The only problem is that there's one word, one adjective missing over here. Greg, it doesn't say HaKohen HaGadol, as it said in the first three. But nevertheless, Rabbi Yehuda insists that since we understand that the Kohen that's being singled out here is the Kohen Gadol, then it's as if the Pasuk had said it. But V'idach, the Rabbanan are not willing to engender this extra limud, Midalok Siv HaGadol, is therefore Chad Mihanachu. This pasuk is referring to one of the Kohanim that was mentioned earlier, or hinted at earlier, the three major psukim. Now, I would say the following, even though the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim revolves around a question of how to dash in the pasuk, but nevertheless we can still derive conclusions here about the status of Kohen Mashiach Melchon. Insofar as the Kohen Mashiach Melchom, although being the boss, the number one top banana as far as Melchom is concerned, he does not have any rights that exceed those of a Kohen Hedjot with regard to the Avoda in general. And therefore the Chachamim, I think, are postulating that even though he may have in some sense a status above that of the Kohen Hedjot, because he and only he can fulfill the mitzvah of Melchom, but nevertheless, he still is not up to par with the other three Kohanim Gadol. And this could have impact on many, many different halachas above and beyond the limitation of Ir Miklat. And finally, the last thing I want to discuss with you is this major question about the tefillah of the Rotzeach. The Mishnah says, L'fichach imoseim shel Kohanim, frek de gemara taima de lo matzlu, the reason why the Kohen is going to live to a ripe old age, is because these rotzkim are not praying to bring about his death. And why is that? Because they're very comfortable living in their mikla, being supported by the mother of the Kohen Gadol. Ha-matzli, if they would in fact stand up and pray, if the mother would not stave off this problem, then apparently Maisi, the Kohen Gadol, would in fact die. That's a real chutzpah, is it not? I mean, do we believe that the Rotzeach has such a power through his tefillah to bring about the death of the most important person in Klal Yisrael? And not only that, Vaksiv, even if it's in, the Gemara is not satisfied with saying it's intuitively antithetical, but it's against the Pasuk. Because the Pasuk in Mishle says, Katzipar la nud, kadror la uf, kein kilas chinom lo tava. Meaning, does every person have the ability to be makalel, to curse someone else and bring about his death or some catastrophe? The Pasuk is telling us that that's not so. And a person is free of the shackles of a kilas chinom. Now, if the klal is justified, then that's a different story. So basically, the Gemara is asking, why should the tefillah of the Rotzeach be accepted on high to bring about the Mises Kohen Gadol? Again, if not for the action of the mother of the Kohen Gadol, the Kohen Gadol is naki, he's clean of avon, of any sin, and therefore his klala, the klala of the rotzeach, is a kilas chinam, and the pasuk says lo tava. Amar ahu saba, the Gemara identifies this elderly gentleman who apparently links us back to an earlier generation. He heard Torah from the earlier generation. Mi pirkei de Rava Shmilei. I was alive to hear the drasha of Rava. You know, not too many people could claim that. You know, Rava died at a very young age. The Gemara tells us he was 40 years old when he died. He came from Beis Eli. And there were very few drushos, and apparently this Zaken could claim that he heard something from Rava. Which is, I always find these comments in the Gemara very fascinating, because you see how the tradition, you know, we glamorize, you know, a person who can claim, he's one of his Canaan, that he links us up to the earlier chain of transmission of Torah. I'll never forget, the Rav once said in Shia that he knew someone who knew someone who was at the bris of the Beis HaLevi. That links us back about 2.5 centuries. No, the Beis HaLevi was probably born in, like, you know, 1790 or something. But the Rav said he met in his youth someone who said, I was schmoozing with someone who told me that he was at the bris of the Beis HaLevi in the year 1780 or whatever year it was. We can look at it. So the Gemara says the following. What did they hear from Rava? Shahayalahem. It's interesting that they talk about the Kohen Gadol in plural. It's almost as if, you know, it's sort of like diffusing the accusation here a little bit. It's, you know, Kohen Gadol in general. Levakesh rachmim al dora v'lo bikshu. This is a pile plum of the Gemara. The Kohen Gadol is in charge of tefillah on behalf of Knesset Yisrael, which means in general to make sure that he prays that the people of Israel should not deviate from the path of the Torah. But specifically with regard to life and death, the Kohen Gadol more than anyone holds the keys through tefillah to bring about a situation which prevents unnecessary death. And when I say unnecessary death, again, we know the Gemara that the person who was killed was somebody, you know, it was Rotzef Bemezer without either, but I'm leaving that out for the time being. But in this case, the very fact that there was a Ritzicha B'Shogeg, and how much more so if that became commonplace in certain areas of Eretz Yisrael and Eber Yadin that we discussed, the fact that this is a phenomenon that is so commonplace is proof positive that the Kohen Gadol did not live up to his responsibility. And here I want to add a comment of the Marsha. The Marsha thinks that the time that was ripe in the Jewish calendar year for the Kohen Gadol to be mispalel was Yom HaKippurim, when he went lifnai v'lifnim. And at that moment, when it's a moment that is ripe with the possibility of bringing about a Kabbalah Satfilah and a Mechilas Avon on behalf of Am Yisrael, says the Marsha, Hoyel Ola Kohen Gadol, V'Yom HaKippurim, V'Spal Al Mechilas Avon L'Kal Yisrael, V'Al Yidei Tfiloso Yizbatlu Kol Gzeros Rav. So imagine the power of the Kohen Gadol. That's why we have all that Avelus on Kohen Gadol in our right. When we speak about Ayin, you know, Lo Rasa, we don't have the Kohen Gadol who had the power on Yom HaKippurim to stave off all these terrible gzeros. And the Marsha continues. He says, "Hayalol ispal shiyashuvu arishon mi'avonoseihem v'inatzlu klal yisrael migzeros rov." And certainly there would not have been all these terrible murders that took place. We'll just read one more piece, and that'll call it. The Ikar D'Amri. Others say that Kidei, like, and this seems to be a different gears than our Mishnah. Kidei Shis Palalu Al Bneihem Shaloya Musa. Correct. We don't have that gears in our Mishnah. We have Kidei Shaloya Palalu Al Bneihem Shaloya Musa. So according to the Ikar D'Amri, it's we're not talking about the mothers staving off the tefillah of the rotzchim just in that simple level, but on the contrary, what they're trying to bring about is to get the Rotzchim on the side of the Kohen Gadol. To the point in which the Kohen Gadol, the point in which the Rotzchim will, the Kuvah say, will positively pray for the life, the continued life of the Kohen Gadol. Says the Aruch HaNer, this girsa of the Ika Demasni of the Lishna Basra is built on the premise that if the Rotzchim are not being mispalel for the Kohen Gadol, then the Kohen Gadol will die. In other words, it's not just that the Kohen Gadol is in a precarious situation where he's vulnerable, he's exposed to the bad, negative tefillos of the Rotzchim. On the contrary, he's doomed to die unless someone saves him. And the Aruch HaNer is going to ask the question, why is it that of all people who have to save him, it's Dafka the Rotzeach who has the power through his tefillah to save the Kohen Gadol? And that, Mirtz Hashem, we'll pick up next time.
Maybe it's part of the teacher.
Do we have a minute?
Yeah, I heard somebody in there.